Hi, this is Stevie Holland, and I'll be returning with my show Love, Linda, The Life of Mrs. Cole Porter to the Triad Theater in New York from October 17 to November 10th. Looking forward to seeing you. And right now, I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By.
Oh, shalom, my friends. Shalom to you all. This is your old buddy, Rabbi Saul Solomon here. And let me tell you something. I've always had a soft spot in my heart for the Dutch. Why? Well, because they sided with us during World War II. They got the pretty tulip flowers. And who doesn't love soft pretzels from the Pennsylvania Dutch? And so it is exciting to me to talk to someone who has Holland in her name. Stevie Holland, the songstress. Let me tell you about this woman. In 2004, she won the Backstage Bistro Award for Outstanding Vocalist of the Year in Nightclub and Cabaret. She has performed at the Iridium, Jazz at Lincoln Center, the Merkin Concert Hall. But right now, she's coming back to perform her best-known show. It's called Love, Linda. And it's all about the life and wife of Cole Porter. So you can see this. It's happening October 17th through November 10th at the Triad over on West 72nd Street. We want to talk to Stevie Holland about her singing, about Cole Porter. USA Today has said that she straddles jazz and pop with, quote, effortless elegance and warmth, which are, of course, the two things I most embody. So please welcome to the neighborhood, Stevie Holland. Shalom to you.
Shalom, Rabbi. How are you?
I'm all right. You know, aches and pains, the usual things, but talking to you, I am delighted. How are you? Are you excited about bringing this show, which you've been working on or doing in various guises for over a decade? Is this true?
Well, we've been developing it over a decade, but we've been doing it for going on 9 years, yes. I'm always excited to bring Linda because it's such a special story to tell.
Now, does it evolve and change, or, you know, did you get it right 8 years ago?
Like a precious child, it has been growing and learning, and as it learns, it develops, and it has blossomed into a very meaningful, beautiful story. It started out as a great idea and a small little script and a very exciting evening kind of act, and it has matured into a real work of theater and a very meaningful and rather deep play, and I'm happy to say that we've been published, and it's now getting performed all over the country and the world. Actually, Berlin, if you can believe it, just had a production. The other, it's been translated to German, and it was just done the other week in Berlin. And
well, have you seen other people do it, and can you sit there objectively?
No, I have not, but I have seen other... I'll tell you this, Rabbi, I have actually seen in one upcoming production somebody take my body and Photoshop the actress's head onto my body. So that one I'd like to see live.
Yeah. Lucky actress. You got a nice body, I'll tell you that. This is... your husband is a lucky man. And we'll talk about him, too. But, you know, she had to live. Linda, Cole Porter's wife, she had to live essentially in his shadow. What were her dreams? Were they subsumed by being married to him?
Not in the least. She was an amazing woman. Before Cole came on the scene, Linda Lee Thomas was a gorgeous Southern belle who was married to a real character who, as we say, had the distinction of, well, he was a newspaper mogul and an auto enthusiast, she calls him, because he had the distinction of being the first American to kill someone in a car accident. He was also a brute, and she, for several years, put up with a lot of abuse, and then back in the 19-teens, she obtained the largest divorce settlement of its time, and Linda took off to Paris and hobnobbed with all the greatest artists and expats at the time and had a spectacular life. And Cole came along after he left Yale and a couple of little initial flops in New York, and they discovered each other, and they were both crazy about each other. She completely knew Cole was gay, and that was fine. She was one of these, you know, we don't get into whether Linda was gay or not herself, but she was a woman who had been through enough and maybe had it with men. Messed around with by men, and so she didn't mind Cole's other appetite.
Well, but was he gay or bisexual? I mean, do you think they had some kind of physical...
Well, no, they absolutely did. I mean, there's no... First of all, Linda had a miscarriage by Cole and through her relations with Cole. You know, Cole was a gay man, but he adored her. He loved beautiful women. She was a stunning woman. She was a worldly woman. She opened up every door door to him, and he gave her talent, artistry, a bohemian, crazy lifestyle. They were, I'd say they were the original Brangelina, those two. They're really a power couple, and they adored each other. Linda's thing was just, you know, she had hoped for discretion back then. You know, she didn't want to be made a fool out of, but she completely accepted Cole's homosexuality, and they, you know, and in the nuances of relationships and life, I mean, you know, you can be gay and you can stray sometimes, and obviously Cole did with Linda, and they were, you know, just very deep companions.
Well, with their understanding, was she able to go out and see other men / women?
I have no doubt that she did.
Oh.
I have no doubt that she did. But again, Linda was, you know, a little less sexually charged, probably, as Cole was. As I said, the discretion was really important. So all of that was being followed beautifully until Cole just became so famous after Broadway, and they moved to Hollywood. And as we say in the script, with all those suntanned Adonises around him, Cole quickly abandoned the discreet behavior I had grown to rely on. So there was a time when, you know, she finally felt made a fool out of, and she went to Paris and filed for divorce. And then Cole followed her, and ultimately she rejected him, but he had a horseback riding accident that rendered him completely crippled at the time. And so Linda ultimately came back and cared for him, and they stayed together until the end of her life. You know, it's an amazing story, just on personally, with the two of them went through health-wise. She had emphysema. She would walk out of an iron lung for an opening night. And Cole went through 30 surgeries with two crushed legs, and his doctors wanted to amputate both of them, but Linda always put her foot down because she knew that would kill Cole's spirit.
Right. And, plus, he couldn't put his foot down for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when Linda died, ultimately, that's when they finally did amputate Cole's leg. And Cole had a very pretty rotten final 6 years of his life without her. But they were together for 35 years. And believe me, there'd be no Cole Porter without Linda.
Well, did she have any writing or musical talent of her own? Did she ever co-write or try and co-write with, or that was totally separate?
Well, again, as we say, she was extremely cultured, extremely artistic and intelligent, and only hung out with, you know, just some of the greatest artists of her time. And I'd say in the script that her opinion was very important to Cole. If something didn't sound quite right to her, he'd march back to that piano and give it another go. Linda got Cole. She wanted him to study with Stravinsky. That didn't work out, but he did end up, she pushed him towards studying classically while he was in Europe, and she nurtured Cole Porter all along the way. She nurtured, she pushed him, she helped him develop his talent, and when the time was right, she was dear friends with Irving Berlin.
Ooh.
And Berlin saw what a talent Cole Porter was, and it was Berlin who got Porter back to the States to start creating Broadway shows. So, I mean, she played a major role in the development of Porter, professionally, artistically, and just as a companion. So whether she did any writing, I don't know, but he certainly respected her opinion, and it factored in many times.
Well, speaking of opinion and development, one of the things that helped develop this show, Love, Linda, is somewhere along the way, Richard Maltby Jr. got involved. Now, he's a mostly known as a songwriter. He did Closer Than Ever and Big on Broadway. So how did he get involved, and what did he bring to the table?
He also is a two-time Tony-winning director. We have respected and known Richard for many years. He is a brilliant and unique talent with his writing abilities and directorial abilities. And after our initial run at the Triad, we had the opportunity to do an off-Broadway premiere at the York Theater in New York. And so we ran the material by Richard and said, hey, are you interested in this? And he just jumped in. He felt very strongly about the strength of the book and the concept and the story. So Richard came on board, and he was just a really brilliant sounding board for me to help develop the book as a dramaturging director. And, you know, the show just went to a whole new level from the initial Triad production to the York production.
Right. I'm curious about the specifics in terms of what you would have done had he never come on board and you were just doing a cabaret act, which was a mix of music.
It was never a cabaret. It was always a hybrid. The one thing about the show is it's no "and then Cole wrote." It's not that kind of thing, and I'm not Stevie. I'm Linda Porter. I play her, and what we do is we take some very well-known and some lesser-known Cole Porter songs completely out of context and use them to further our narrative. And it's always been a very sort of interesting hybrid show. The book just became richer and richer and richer and developed because every time we did it, people wanted more, more, more. They just wanted more story and more. Linda and I, and I've been very cautious to never, of course there's artistic license taken as a writer, but I've done an enormous amount of research with this project. The Cole Porter Trust is our partner. Bob Kimball, the historian, is, 100% respect for this product and behind it and considers it one of the greatest Cole Porter shows ever created. So it wasn't really cabaret. It was a hybrid. But it was always a little, mixture theater, and it felt cabaret because initially at the Triad we had like a standing mic, and you've got this woman up there singing Cole Porter songs, so it seems like a cabaret show, but it's not. We got rid of the handheld mic and went to the body mic, and then went to a bigger set, and put it in a more theatrical theater environment, and then
that's what I'm getting at. In other words, specific suggestions that Maltby made that you didn't think of yourself, like improvements that he made, suggestions of songs.
Actually, Richard never suggested any songs. I have always, the songs have been completely my choice, not even Gary's. I have chosen the songs, and then Gary and I discussed arrangement approaches, and then Gary William Friedman put his brilliant spin on the arrangements, and then also Gary wrote a lot of original music that the show is constantly underscored. There's beautiful themes and additional original music. Richard, to take it from the Triad production to the York, first you're putting it on a bigger theatrical stage, you're creating a set, you have props, you're creating an environment and a world for Linda to now live in instead of just a, more cabaret-type space. You're putting a body mic on her so she can now start holding things and doing things and, acting a little more than just the constraints of a handheld mic. And then Richard, just as, writer to writer, just got me thinking at times, maybe this line we can, are you really saying as much as you want to say there? So he'd nudge and prod and get me to rethink some of my writing. And there are there are one or two lines that Richard absolutely did contribute to this project. And I'll
make
that a mystery for this juncture.
Now,
but the script is largely mine. It is my words, and Gary functioned as a brilliant editor, partner, dramaturg on it, too, and so that's why it's this book by Stevie Holland with Gary William Friedman, and it's been a collaborative process. So.
Now, well, you mentioned Gary William Friedman. We should tell people that you are married to this composer, the guy who wrote The Me Nobody Knows. How long ago did you guys meet?
Well, I was a child bride, of course. We were introduced by mutual friends who knew my work as a lyricist and singer, and Gary had written an opera, actually, Joanna Simon, Carly Simon's sister, that family, who was a beautiful opera singer, and her husband, who was a writer. Gary had worked with Jerry Walker, and Jerry and Joanna knew my work, and they actually introduced us and suggested that we collaborate together as a songwriting team. And that was, okay, folks, about 21 years ago.
Not that long ago. I thought you were going to say
we're
like
we're celebrating 57. Our 19th wedding anniversary, so.
Oh, mazel. So.
Thank you.
Is that difficult? I mean, you still collaborate. He's helped you on this particular show. You guys are working on a musical that we can talk about. Well, actually, I'll ask you now. You guys are working on something called Merton of the Movies, which is an old George S. Kaufman play and adapted various ways. Anything happening with that, by the way?
Well, we have just been, I mean, it's all been about rights securing and getting it outward. Now it's about the next level, and we have a couple of possible regional theaters interested in developing it, or we might just do the old workshop route in New York. So we're trying to decide that right now, but we're, it's not headed towards a New York production yet. This is a project that actually Gary had worked on some years ago at Carnegie Mellon. He was brought out, and Mel Shapiro, who's also involved with this, was teaching and directing. Mel Shapiro wrote,
I don't know off the top of my head.
Suddenly had my blanket. Gentleman of Verona.
And he's
directed a lot of John Guare works and such.
Oh.
Mel was teaching out there, and they did work on it years ago with a man named Robert Lorick, Tap Dance Kid, and they did a production. Actually, a young Rob Marshall was in it at the time. And anyhow, it was a big hit and very close to getting to the Great White Way, but too many, again, complications happened. People went other directions. Anyway, back in the trunk, and Bob Lorick passed away, but his executor, who is also an active and blossoming producer, Lyle Saunders, came along and wanted to get the work out again, and then I was brought in as an additional book writer to the script. Needed some work in developing, and I wrote some new songs with Gary, and anyway, so now we're all...
But here's the deal. You and Gary William Fried, you know, you're married, you live together, been together for 2 decades, so is it...
Spend way too much time together.
Yeah.
Let's get that straight. Okay.
Is it, I mean, is that difficult? I mean, you know, you got to work together, and then you have an argument about something else completely. Can you then go back to the piano? Is it like a they're playing
a song
situation?
The good thing is that we can argue about everything. That's the...
Yeah?
there's no... We argue about everything, so it all kind of evens out. Yes, no, it never gets so heated that we stop working. And actually, we just finished recording. Hopefully, we'll all hear it. A commercial for public service announcement for AARP.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
We do all sorts of things.
Well, speaking of all sorts of things, there's another show that Gary William Friedman was involved with on Broadway. This is going back to 1978, called Platinum. Are you revising that?
Well, Platinum, yes, which starred Alexis Smith. And by the way, Alexis Smith also played Linda Porter in the movie Night and Day.
Oh.
This is all just so much involuted stuff in our lives here, but... Platinum originally started as a show called called Sunset up in Buffalo, and Tommy Toon was the original director. It was a big hit. Tommy had a falling out with the producer, moved from there to Broadway. Joe Layton became the director, and so many things happened from Buffalo to Broadway, and the show was, I just will say, was ill-treated in many ways and did not ultimately get the reviews it deserved, and then it went from Broadway to a small cabaret act with Tammy Grimes called Sunset again, and then it went in the trunk. And I, years later, said to Will Holt, who was the original book writer, and I mean, Bruce Valange came in at one point in the Broadway run, but I said, you know, we can't let this score go. But the show has always been dogged by problems with the book. People didn't love the two main characters, the Hollywood movie star and the rock star, wanting their comeback. So with Will's blessings, I took it, and I whittled it down to three characters.
Mm.
Lila Halliday, the star, Dan, the rock star, and Jamie, the recording studio owner. And I created a three-person show with Gary. And we did do a very successful reading at the York Theater last year, and we're developing that. And that's one of the next things on the horizon. We'll see what happens with that in this business called Schmell.
It's true. And, you know, it's just, you have to have all these different projects in the hopper, all these different things percolating, so that when it's time to grab one, it's like, okay, we're ready. That's the nature of the beast. But let's roll it back with Stevie Holland here. First of all, I say that name is your Norwegian-Italian, I think, in your background. What name is on your birth certificate?
Oh, my birth certificate is actually Olivieri. My father was Italian, and my mother was Norwegian.
But Stevie, is that, where did that come from?
That came from Stephanie.
Oh, okay. Well, so from when you were a kid, people called you that, or when did Stevie take?
Well, I actually had a twin brother named Stephen. You see what happened. My mother, we were her sixth pregnancy, and back at that time, she was a very hardy Viking, and didn't know she had two children inside of her, and... So 6 days before delivery, she actually found out. But my parents had basically planned, if it's a boy, Stephen Michael. If it's a girl, Stephanie Michelle. And then we were born, and they didn't get creative. They just said, you, Stephen Michael. You, Stephanie Michelle. And when I was growing up, I really wasn't a Steffi. He was Stevie when we were little. So in my high school yearbook, you've got Steffi, Stevie, Harry. I had a bunch of nicknames. And by the time we graduated, I said, Stephen, do you mind if I just stick with Stevie? And he said, no, I'm Steve now. So anyway.
That works out. I'm glad I asked that question. That is so, and by
now
the way,
it's out. Now it is out in the world, Rebbe. You've exposed me.
Well, I don't know about that. But let me move forward into your school years, because, and I always do this, the producer and host of this radio program, Dave Lefkowitz, he went to New York University.
I feel like you know him very well.
I know, yeah, he's almost a doppelganger, I would say that. If I used German words, that's the word I would use. But he went to a place called New York University, Tisch School of the Arts. I believe you're familiar with that as well.
I am. And when did this good producer go there?
Oh, he was back there in the early 1980s, through the mid-1980s.
Really? Well, that's sort of when I was there.
Oh, good Lord. Well, he was in film, TV, and playwriting and all that crap. Where were you? Were you in acting?
I decided instead of, well, I did want to do, they had a program for drama majors, and you know, were signed an acting company. I didn't want to be part of the musical theater scene. I felt I had done so much musical theater as a kid. I really wanted serious acting training. And anyway, I ended up at an ensemble called the Experimental Theater Wing. And there, young Ann Bogart was my first.
Oh my God!
Direct.
Was Richard Schechner as part of that too? Was he?
That name I don't remember. A man named Ron Arglander ran the department.
Okay, cool. So, any great memories or not so great memories of taking classes at NYU?
Yes.
Oh, like what?
Yes. Oh, doing movement class and looking down over Waverly Street and watching all the guys and come out of the back of the deli watch us. I don't know. It was very professional. It was wonderful. We'd have Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It was intensive acting training, and Tuesday, Thursday, academia. And it was just a wonderful experience. I knew it was an honor and a privilege to have. So
now,
there aren't that many memories that I can. They're too long to go into, so I'm going to take a pass on that one.
No problem. Well, I hope you won't pass on this one because also you must have known pretty early, since you were already going to college for this kind of thing, that you had a talent. Your whole family was kind of musical, ..
Yes. Well, my mother was a glorious operatic soprano, and if she had not had seven children, she probably would have had a great career with the Met or with a Norwegian touring company. My dad was a musician, but he ultimately became a commercial artist. His brother, my Uncle Mike, was, yes, a very successful band leader and musician, and he was actually Fred Astaire's music director.
Whoa!
So,
yeah, wow,
yeah.
Okay. Did he tell you stories, any stories you remember about Fred Astaire?
He just said that Fred never stopped moving. You know, Fred would be shaving his face, and he'd be tapping in the mirror and cutting his face. But if you read Fred Astaire's biography, Steps in Time, he has a whole chapter on the USO, and he does talk about Mike Olivieri, who was my uncle. But my uncle, unfortunately, had cancer and died relatively young, so I didn't get to grow up and really ask him the kind of questions I would have liked to at a more mature age in my life. But
when you were young and little, like 5, 6, 7, 8, did you get up and sing it?
I was very young. We have this. Yeah. Both my parents were married before my mother's first husband passed away, and she had four children, and then she married my dad and had us three. I'm the youngest of a large group of children, and my father was older, so I'm rather young to be having an uncle who was Fred Astaire's music director. But there's a big spread in my family. My oldest sister is actually about 16 years older than I, so.
Well, you're also rather young to be doing the kind of music that you do, as opposed to 60s, 70s pop rock. Even though you've done some Carly Simon, even though you've done some of that, you're dipping into a generation earlier, really, musically, of what you're doing. So how did that come about?
Well, definitely just my upbringing. I mean, I was a few years old, and I brought out orange juice to a purple painted bus that one of my brothers came back on from Woodstock, and my first concert, I was 8 years old. My sister brought me, one of my sisters, to the Beacon Theater to hear Carole King, and I mean, I was extremely influenced by all sorts of rock and pop and soft rock in the 70s, influenced my brain, you know, just as far as nostalgia goes. But my parents, I mean, my dad was just a nut, and we would sit down by that hi-fi, as we called it back in the day, and he would just play everything. He was a jazz aficionado. I had to learn Ben Webster solos, and I was just very influenced musically in a very broad way through my family. We loved the theater. My parents love jazz. They love opera. They love the theater.
Well, do you remember the first show you went to, whether it was on Broadway or somewhere else?
No, I don't, because it's funny. My first New York theatrical experience I remember was actually like the holiday show at Radio City.
Uh-huh.
They played the who was in this one? It was the Christmas Carol movie.
Scrooge?
I think it was just, yeah, they gave it the title Scrooge. And so it had to be back in the early 70s, I guess. But I don't remember my first Broadway shows. I know later in my early teens, I actually went to see Ain't Misbehavin'. We're speaking of Richard Maltby.
Oh, that Richard Maltby directed, that's right. Do you have a favorite all-time Broadway musical?
Do I have a favorite all-time?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, when I was a kid, I was in a production of West Side Story. I dyed my hair black and played Anita. So that's always been one of my, you know...
Yeah, because I see the Norwegian side of Anita at certain points. No, I'm kidding.
Yes. Of course, of course. But, you know, West Side Story is certainly up there with one of my all-time favorites. But, I just never like to...
Oh, sure.
I like the list of favorites. There's just too much good stuff out there.
I imagine Kiss Me, Kate is pretty important to you at this point.
Kiss Me, Kate is very important, and it certainly factors into our current story, Mr. Cole Porter. So, yes.
Since you're a singer, do you have a favorite all-time Cole Porter lyric?
Oh, dear.
One that just dazzles you every time you sing it or you see it on the page?
That's really tough. I just can't. Every single song I've picked in this show from... So in love to, what is this thing called love to, Night and Day. No, I just can't do it. They're all beloved children, and that's me as a writer and a singer. I can't do it, Rabbi.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can all go see and admire Stevie Holland's children by going to the Triad Theater in New York. It's October 17th through November 10th. It's called Love, Linda. For more information and tickets, you can go to triadnyc.com, triadnewyorkcity.com, or Stevie Holland's own website, where you can buy her albums and see pictures and find out a lot more about her, is stevieholland.com. Just have one or two more questions for you before we let you go. I have to ask this. Being who you were and then meeting and marrying Gary William Friedman, I mean, did you didn't convert? I mean, how do you deal with the religion thing?
Well, Gary, God bless him. He's paid a lot of dues. He's written he's written a lot of liturgical music. He actually raised two children and did his best to educate them in the ways. His first wife passed away, I will mention, when we married, just in case there's any question. Did he?
Oh, yeah.
Horse and no, he was, and he took care of her for 15 years of illness. But no, Gary is very spiritual. We both are, but neither of us are truly religious in, you know, the sense of organized religion. So we find a nice balance. I've been to many services. Listen, I've sung in Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah services. I've dragged Gary to some Christmas Eve carol services. That's about the extent for me and my church going. Now, I was much more, as a kid, I was exposed to much more religion, and I had my fill by the time I was 17. So we're both kind of ecumenical and very spiritual, though.
Now, another question that I do want to ask you, I mean, I know this is more of a theatrical performance, but mostly you are a recording artist, a singing person, you have a bunch of solo CDs out, but in terms of nightclub and cabaret, there's always that worry, that feeling that everybody who's going to these things is 60, 70, 90 years old. Are you getting, when you go concertize, 20, 30, 40-year-olds?
Absolutely. Well, particularly since my album started branching out more into the jazz world and my vocal direction, I definitely get a broad... I'm at 20. I can't... You know, it's some of the theatrical productions, yes. But I'm not going to say I get a bunch of 20-year-olds, but I certainly get them in their 30s and 40s. And what can I say? I don't know why or how. Every theater has its own population, I suppose, that frequent that particular theater. But I found with Love, Linda, we've been really... really blessed and really surprised, I suppose, that there's quite a cross-section, age-wise, race-wise, everything. It's just, it's not what you might think would be the
median age
demographic, yeah.
Yeah. Last question for you, like, being a master of the craft that you are, do you have any advice for people who maybe want to go on American Idol one day, or do you hate that show, or for just people who want to do what you do?
I don't even know if I've actually ever watched it.
Yeah.
First of all, I had a brilliant voice instructor, and I did teach privately some students I have on and off through the years. And, you know, I will say all sound is meaning. Everything you put out there means something.
Mm.
protect your voice, be healthy, treat it as you would go to the gym. You have to do scales, you have to take care of it. I've never been a fan of, like, over pushing the pop belting and damage, and just really be true. I'm really, really so turned off by pyrotechnics and frills and trills for the sake of frills and trills. I do believe in honesty. If you're singing a song, you're telling a story, the lyric is always the most important to me first, before the music. And, of course, gotta be good music, too, but lyric first. Just be true. Be true and have something to say and know what you're saying.
Well, it is absolutely true that we've had a delightful time talking with Stevie Holland, star and creator of Love, Linda. It's at the Triad Theater from the middle of October through early November. Go get your tickets at triadnyc.com. Find out more at stevieholland.com. You are indeed a tulip, a growing, blossoming tulip in the neighborhood. And all I can say is wish you much continued success, great singing, love with your Jewish husband, and...
Thank you, Rebbe.
Mazel and gazoot.
Total pleasure, a total pleasure. And all my best to you. I hope you'll be joining us for one performance.
I would love to, and shalom to you.
Shalom to you, too.